Cinéphile. Roslyn Hyams.
Hello and thank you for joining me for this month's Cinéphile. It's an end of summer cinephile where at the Venice International Film Festival, the Mostra opened to the howls of media and others over the most publicised issues of the moment in the film biz, i.e. sexual abuse, harassment and gender parity. So British documentary filmmaker Ursula McFarlane's Untouchable couldn't have had a better release time in France at the end of August, as well as the major international film festival season. Locarno, Venice, Toronto, for example, Untouchable opened here just when there was a new twist in the case against Harvey Weinstein, accused of rape, harassment and abuse of power. Unexpectedly, his trial was postponed until January 2020. A Hollywood entertainment film, completely different from Ursula McFarlane's Untouchable, released just about the same time. It's written by Mindy Kaling, who plays a rookie TV comedy screenwriter seeking not only recognition and love, but first and foremost, equality. Late Night, directed by US-Canadian director Nisha Ganatra, stars British actress Emma Thompson as an ageing late night TV chat show host who's struggling to stay in the game.
Ça tourne.
Here's the official trailer extract from McFarlane's classical and compelling documentary, where known and unknown people speak out candidly.
I went with no plan, no agent, very little money.
Here was I meeting one of the most powerful men in Hollywood.
I was going to have dinner with him at the Beverly Hills Hotel.
He said, "Can we have a drink upstairs at yours?"
So obviously this is the part that's very hard to talk about.
Harvey Weinstein was known to be a bully.
He could do anything.
He thought of himself as the sheriff in town.
When you read about rape, you read she kicks and screams.
I just froze.
I said no and I pushed them away more than once, and then I just stopped.
I couldn't believe that they were telling the story as though they were writing about me.
Mr. Weinstein intends to enter a plea of not guilty.
When you pick out the most grotesque, there's the sense that, okay, we've taken care of the problem.
It's not over.
Rosanna Arquette, Paz de la Huerta, Erica Rosenbaum, journalists, former employees of Miramax, from execs to communication workers. The filmmaker reminds viewers about Weinstein's climb to fame and his resounding fall. I met Ursula McFarlane in Paris ahead of the release of Untouchable.
Cinéphile, guest of the month.
Ursula McFarlane, thank you very much for speaking to us today here in Paris. Your film, The Untouchable, came out in August here in France. It's a documentary. The information is information that a lot of people may already have heard. Mm-hmm. But there are some revelations that people perhaps didn't know about his background, his youth, his relationship with his brother, mm-hmm. his relationship with executives at Miramax, where apparently the abuse of power knew no gender distinction.
A lot has been written and said, obviously, as you say. The New York Times, New Yorker did a lot of extraordinary investigative journalism. So some of those stories were already out there. But we kind of thought, well, this is film, and obviously film can do something different. You can put the voices in the faces, and they're actually telling you their stories, which is profound, and you see the pain on their faces, you see the shame and all of those things that have been stored up for years. So that was our starting point, that we would give literal voice to those women. But I think we also wanted to set it in the context of almost like a Greek tragedy. You know, that's how I conceived it, a Greek tragedy in three acts that told you of the rise, the gluttony, the hunger for power that this man had, and then the way he managed to wield it when he was at the top and abuse his power, and then obviously the crushing shoot, the downfall. We wanted people to understand it in the context of power, because in a way this is a portrait of power, and that makes it relatable to other people in other industries. You know, Hollywood is pretty sort of out there for lots of people. You know, they'll never have brushes with it, but actually what you can see by this story is that there are many Harvey Weinsteins, men generally, who have wielded huge power in lots of industries. And that could be the guy who runs the McDonald's where you work, you know, who's threatening you with losing your job if you don't do this, that or the other. So I tried to make it more of a sort of archetypal story about someone who's hungry for power, who gets power, who abuses power. And so along the way, it was important to understand why he was so, why he became so big, and also what drew people to him. So, you know, some people call him a monster, but I don't really believe in monsters. I think people are more complicated than that. And I think he was an extremely complicated, complexed man with a massive chip on his shoulder. And plenty of people who worked for him, certainly at the beginning, but even later on, found him immensely charming and knowledgeable and an almost obsessive lover of cinema. And he knew, you know, he loved literature. He loved English literature. He loved French literature. You know, he was the guy who made sure that we saw Cinema Paradiso and Il Postino and Chocolat and all these films that, personally, growing up, I'm not sure I'd have seen were it not for Harvey Weinstein. You know, so he did it. I mean, cinema owes the debt to Harvey Weinstein. So we wanted to make sure people understood that before we got into the terrible stuff that, you know, people are now accusing him of having done, to put it in that context. And I don't think that had been done before. So I think that was our sort of starting point, is to kind of create the context, create the backdrop of power.
Did you at any stage contemplate or try to get in touch with Harvey Weinstein, his lawyer? We see his lawyer making statements at the time of the hearings. Did you actually try to get in touch with them, or did you try writing them into this documentary?
Yeah, of course. I mean, apart from anything else, we have to legally give him a right to reply for all the allegations that are made in the film. I would love to have interviewed Harvey Weinstein. You know, that's sort of on my wish list, definitely. And even, to be honest, I had this kind of little fantasy. I had this running list of questions that I would add to every week. And I'm going to ask him this. And of course, it was a fantasy, because of course he's never going to take part. And of course, if he did, he would just say no comment. But I think even to have him in the chair and just see his face and his body language would have been fascinating. So, yeah, we approached him several times, asked him for an interview, or, okay, if you can't do an interview, what about your lawyer? Speak on your behalf. And obviously the answer came back, no. No, I've already told you no. No. But in a way, what would he say other than that, you know, I deny all the allegations. And I guess they've been very busy over the past year preparing for the trial and the civil cases. So, you know, it's a shame. But, you know, maybe one day I'll get that interview. In prison, possibly.
There is a line at the end of the film, scripted, that says that he denies the allegations and that insists that all the encounters were consensual.
I always imagine, like plenty of people in this industry, that actresses slept with Harvey because it was good for their career.
When I tried to tell people, they say, you better keep your mouth shut. Well, I saw a lot about how the machine works in terms of burying scandals and settlements.
I was hearing stories which you could dismiss as rumor.
I was being told these women are crazy.
The most sinister aspect is that the system enabled it.
Through the work that the New Yorker and the New York Times have done, you know, it's clear that there was a lot of complicity. You know, managers and agents sent young women into those hotel suites, probably knowing, you know, the New York Times did a big investigation on that. You know, definitely it was being talked about. So people can't turn around and say we knew nothing. I think there's a kind of range of knowledge. I absolutely don't think that everybody knew everything, which some people accuse them of. I think a few people probably knew a lot, and I think a lot of people guessed but turned a blind eye. I think some people genuinely didn't know. And then I think there's a whole range of people who kind of suspected and saw someone who was a bully and violent in the office and didn't really quite want to believe that he could be like that in private. So, but that's human nature. And I do want people to watch the film and sort of, in a way, apply it to their own lives. You know, have we all been in situations? I certainly have. Did I do the right thing? Did I speak up for that person who was being bullied? Maybe not always, you know. So I think these are things that audiences can relate to. That's not just about Harvey Weinstein.
Very important to talk about the women in your film, yeah, who bear witness a range of ages, but most of them had these encounters with Harvey Weinstein when they were quite young. Mm. A Canadian woman her story starts off very slowly. You bring her back in and out of the narrative of the film. Why did you choose her particularly?
Erica Rosenbaum. I mean, first of all, she's an amazing woman. She's very open. She's very warm. I knew that she'd be a very relatable sort of character in the film, if I can call her that. And I also felt that her story was very emblematic of the subtlety of that dance between often actresses and someone like Harvey Weinstein. Because a lot of people said to me, I suddenly found myself in this situation and I'm like, is this really happening? Is he really taking his trousers off? Do I laugh this off? Do I kind of play along with it so he doesn't get angry? And remember, you know, a lot of actresses are very small and slim, and this guy is big. So there's all these different things running through their minds. And I think she kind of, in a way for me, expressed that really well. I mean, you could say, why did you go back? You know, knowing that he was the things that he'd done the first time that she managed to escape and get away with. Why did you go back? And she's very honest about it. You know, she wanted a job. And he had promised her he could make her a star, you know, so she wants to go back and get what she was promised. And at the same time, she doesn't want to upset him. You know, it's a bizarre thing, and I think a lot of women would relate to that.
The film industry moves towards gender equality. We're hearing more about that, the moves to try and prevent sexual harassment, although that's obviously part of it's a way of dealing with it, and also more generally in society, whether it's here in France, in the UK, in the States, wherever.
Well, the first thing is I think people have slightly forgotten the Harvey Weinstein story, in the sense that it's been in the news over the last year, but mainly quite technically, like how's the case doing, you know, what cases have been dropped, what cases are coming through, when's the trial, oh, the trial's been postponed, it's that kind of thing. And I think we've sort of slightly lost sight of the reason for this, which is these women speaking out. So I'm kind of proud and determined that, you know, this film is coming out around the time of his trial. I think that's going to get the conversation going again. For good and bad, and I'm sure there are people who again will come and criticise those women, and then there will be a debate about that, which I think is very healthy and important. So I think, you know, wherever it goes around the world, I hope it just opens a dialogue, and I hope it makes people angry, because I think anger is really important. You know, I mean, speaking out is the first thing. People need to react, and then obviously concrete things need to change in workplaces, but it's, you know, it's not going to happen overnight. And I don't think for one minute that the Harvey Weinstein story is suddenly going to magically change anything. And who knows what's going to happen at that trial. But it's part of a conversation. It's, you know, and it's an important conversation.
Ursula McFarlane, thank you very much.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Welcome and bienvenue. Welcome.
Take two.
And now for something not quite completely, but very different, at least in its tone.
I've spread my dreams under your feet. Tread softly because you tread on my dreams. Fudge!
I'm in a single-income household, and Jen and I just had our second baby. I think it's time for a raise.
I can't give you a raise, Gabe. It's like giving a raise to a drug addict.
My child's like a drug problem.
You're fired. Who are you?
I'm Molly. Mm-hmm. I'm a new writer.
You want to sit down?
Okay.
That's for Mendelsohn tits.
Could you sit down, please?
Oh, I'll just use this trash can. There's, you know, there's hardly any trash in it at all. Oh, it's kind of comfortable, better than a chair.
That's our show, everyone.
That's Late Night, Nisha Ganatra's latest movie, which takes place in New York. It stars real-life screenwriter Mindy Kaling as Molly, a youngish, cute and witty comedy writer, and Emma Thompson as Catherine Newbery, beautifully aging TV late-night show presenter, sliding down the popularity ratings.
What exactly is wrong with my bits?
You're a little old and a little white.
What can I do about that?
I have some jokes for the monologue. I shouldn't do this in an English accent, should I?
No.
And here's Emma Thompson and Mindy Kaling, the banter continuing off the screen.
You know, it's hard to talk about your own movie as being important. It feels like that is something other people need to say about it, and
yeah.
Not us.
Not us.
So
yeah.
We tried to make a movie that felt real with, you know, the two of us portraying the characters, which in this day and age, having a a woman. I'm 39, and Emma was in her mid-50s when she did this. It in itself is a political act because people aren't used to that. But we tried to do a funny movie that was really real. And I think if messages about inequity of pay, diversity in the workplace, you know, that's a lot of the themes of the movie that rings true to people, then we're really happy about that.
But while we were shooting it, when we were working together, we weren't saying, are we getting our message across? We were saying, can we make this any funnier?
Yes, exactly.
Can we make this funnier? Is there any way of making this funnier? Yeah. And that's what we would do. That was our focus.
I wrote the movie, this is probably a stupid thing to do as a writer, but I wrote the movie with only one person who could play the part, which is Emma. And I spent 3.5 years writing it very slowly on weekends and never having met her and living in Los Angeles and just thinking about her, which is a pretty perverted thing to do, actually. But luckily, you were receptive to that.
It was just the best script I'd read in years. In years. Because it was so funny and so bright, so smart. Smart as a whip, and just made me laugh out loud. And I loved the character. I loved the journey that she went on as well. I even just hate myself for saying that. Journey went on? Sorry. I just love the story. The story is fabulous. I thought about latter-day Johnny Carson and his sort of the ease, the sort of urbane charm. All of that, and then Letterman in his early days watching that, and then his bite. But of course, there were no women to watch in that sense, and she's very much not in the sort of Joan Rivers style. So I took that and then forgot about it and did it how I would do it, I think.
I need you, Ollie. I need your pushiness and lack of boundaries.
You love me.
No, I didn't say that. No.
I mean, not in those words, but you...
No, I didn't say it in any of those words.
Can Molly save Catherine from being a white woman over 50 in a male for men terrain in a world of youth power, Instagram and popularity ratings? Topical as this one is in underlining the tough fight for equality and against sexism and ageism, it draws laughs and sighs, but overall, and despite some possibly willfully cheesy bits, ticks the Hollywood feel-good boxes. A little understanding goes a long way. McFarlane's film, meanwhile, shows how Weinstein sought power and how in achieving it, it made him weak, because he really believed he was untouchable. In Late Night, we see how vulnerable men and women who wield power can be. Well, that's it for this month's Cinephile. Join me, Roslyn Hyams, next month for a look at some of the latest French films out and forthcoming. Thank you for listening, and until next time, goodbye.
Take 87. On est pas bien, là?